A lot of the objections about sharing medical data comes from people who are privacy advocates. Whenever we have asked patients what they think should happen to their data, most people tend to believe that if something good can come out of their data, they're willing to share. And this is about 70 to 80% of people who suffer from a chronic disease.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Vishal Gulati says he was genetically predisposed to be a doctor. But as it turns out, he was born to be a pioneer in open data, international venture capital, and digital health.
This is Tectonics. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan. And today's episode is brought to you by HealthXL, a global enterprise that empowers leading organizations and innovators to solve major healthcare problems through digital health collaborations.
Wow. So open data. Everyone seems to be talking about the value of sharing and the value of having everyone have access to all of the data, but it's the challenge. It seems to be this challenge between sort of stated and revealed preference, where everyone talks about wanting to share, but it's so hard to get people to do it.
Nobody ever wants to share. That's the kindergarten lesson, right? I got to believe that in the end, there's going to have to be some method of commerce for the sharing to occur, as opposed to just the goodwill of man.
So altruism. So you get further with altruism and a little bit of money than altruism alone.
You get further along with altruism and a lot of money, I think, is the real answer. But transitioning on, Vishal Gulati is a physician, and during his medical training, he realized that the practice of one doctor seeing one patient at a time just wasn't scalable. Probably needed some open data there. Rather than spend his career practicing medicine as his father and grandfather had done before him, Vishal was there at the birth of the open data movement and during the Human Genome Project, and was a key driver in the creation of the digital health ecosystem in Europe.
Ecosystem, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, really. Bingo. Always adept at seeing the trends coming, Vishal has spent the last 16 years as a venture capitalist, focused initially on India and now on Europe as a partner of DFJ Esprit. How are you doing today, Vishal?
I'm very well, Lisa and David. Thank you for having me.
Really nice to have you here, and thank you for being on the show today. And, you know, I wanted to start by asking you, Vishal, I know you grew up in India and said you were genetically predestined to be a doctor. You said that your investment thesis on the venture side has really been informed by this medical training, which, quote, protects you from the delusion that making major healthcare advances is ever easy, unquote. Why do you say that? Why is it so difficult to make these advances in your mind?
I think that healthcare profession tends to be conservative, and it is conservative for good reasons. You don't want to change your practice every day when you see something new, and because it might harm patients. But what that does is when real innovation comes, which is valuable for patients, also takes a longer time before it gets given to patients as routine. So I strongly believe that we are on the path where we are making significant advances. But when it comes to changing clinical practice, we will face certain hurdles. But over time, the speed will increase.
You know, it's so interesting because so a guest that we had last year, Bijan Navamed, was also recently on the wonderful Dan Diamond podcast. And one of the things that he talked about was just sort of the amount of the different rate of change that you can expect in healthcare versus tech. And he seemed to be much more optimistic that while technology itself can feature sort of disruptive change and things that are almost these quantum leaps, his core thesis seemed to be that change in healthcare, because of the nature of healthcare, is almost inevitably incremental. And he sort of seemed to suggest that people should sort of suck it up and accept that and work within that constraint. How do you feel about that?
I feel slightly differently. I think that we should continue to force change. We should continue to make the argument for change. And I think we should do it at many different levels. We should do it at the political level. We should do it at the economic level. We should do it at the patient level. And I think that when you do it at several different levels, then you're more likely to make that change.
So, Vishal, let's go back a ways, because I know you started off growing up in a really small town in India, and then you went straight up to the UK for a Rhodes Scholarship. How did your
background... You were just about to do one of those, weren't
you? Oh, yeah. I was going to do the Rhodes Scholarship, but I had
close.
To go grocery shopping.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering that must have been such a profound change for you. But also, I wonder how all of that and growing up where you did and affected your perspective as an investor.
Well, I think that it was very interesting because when I moved from India to the UK, everything was very different. And I had lived in a country which was still trying to move away from its socialist past and landed up in what I thought was a land of capitalism, because I did not visit the United States for a few years after that. So it was very different. What was the other thing which was very, very different and was profoundly impactful in my life was that there was a very strong feeling in people around me that technology and science can really change the world. And I think that that is much more strongly visible around me in the UK, and it was not so visible when I was growing up in India. When I was growing up in India, we were trying to make do with the things we had rather than invent new things that could change the world for the better.
But yet you started a venture fund to invest in healthcare in India. It was one of the early things you did in your venture career.
Yes, that's right. I started my investment career in the UK, investing in Western Europe and in the United States. But then for a brief period, I invested out of India, investing in healthcare companies, which was quite interesting in 2008 and 9 when the growth in India was just growing through the roof, and there were a lot of opportunities out there. And what I found in India at the time was that there was this ability to turn things. If you had a product, you could turn a lot of volume of that product very quickly. And that was something that was quite transformative, if you recall, in the generics drug industry. So what was still lacking in India was the innovation part, so, which is why I still focus more on the Western world, because I like the innovative part of venture capital.
So did that, what did you really learn about that experience trying to translate healthcare innovation to India? Was it just not possible at the time? Do you think it's changed?
I think it may have changed, but I think there was still the lack of belief that people had that innovation can actually change the world. And that has to be the core belief in the community where you practice venture capital, where you are going to take risk on innovation. And which is why I think that I still feel that piece is lacking in India at the current moment.
Let's go back to another project that you are involved in. You know, part of our dilemma here is you've been involved in so many interesting things. We want to do some of them justice. It turns out that you were present at the start of the Human Genome Project as a researcher with the Wellcome Trust, and you had a real opportunity to think about what to make and what are the consequences, what's the good that can be done with the data that came out of it. Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences, your early experiences with that project and that effort, and how you think that's evolved, the sort of what were some of the initial assumptions, what was learned from it initially, and what are some of the ramifications today, where arguably we're sort of going through a second round of it with the the rapid sequencing of the genome, but people still struggling to make sense of the information?
Yes, I think that was a very interesting time. I was at the Wellcome Trust in the late 90s when we were approaching the end of the sequencing of the human genome, and there was this growing sort of need within the organization and outside, is what are we going to do with the data we get out of the sequencing of genomes? So they started something called the Post-Genomic Project, which I was a part of. And the idea was that you would want to try and fund those people who would take benefit from the sequence data and then move that forward to the next stage to develop. At that time, we thought we would be developing cures, and we had heavily overestimated the speed at which that change is going to come into translational medicine. So we were at that time, if you like, at the peak of the Gartner curve, that this is going to be revolutionary. This is going to absolutely change everything.
If you talk to people like Michael Joyner, he sort of feels like that's still an issue, that, you know, that the field of that sort of the genomics or precision medicine is still in a period of, or at least until recently, he would argue, has been in a period of sort of hype and excessive, sort of extravagant expectations, where people think that you're gonna, now that you can sequence genomes for $1,000, the cures are gonna start pouring out. And he sort of really worries that that's been overstated. On the other hand, we had Ewan Ashley recently on the show, and he talked about, you know, really the progress that's been made in terms of developing treatments for kids with rare disease, for other conditions. And there are really a number, you know, if you think of NIPT. So where do you locate, that's a great question, actually, where do you locate genetics now with your experience as both a researcher and an investor on the Gartner hype cycle?
Well, I think that I would probably be more towards the optimistic end of that spectrum.
Have you backed that up with your own money?
Yes, I have invested in companies that are involved in that sector, and I continue to look for them. But where I am actually seeing things changing, when you look at the price of sequencing the genome, it may not be immediately obvious to a lot of people that a lot of these sequences are done in the preclinical side of things. So one of my companies has sequences of PDX models, which are used by pharma company to make drugs. These drugs per se do not, quote unquote, are genomic drugs. These are antibodies or these are small molecules, but the development pathway has been cut short by several years because we use genomic sequencing in that pathway. So not all the impact of genomics is going to be obvious in form of something that has a genomics written all over it. If you actually look inside what's going on, we are definitely benefiting from genomics at that level.
So, you know, a lot of companies that I see come in with stories about the data and how they're going to monetize the data and, you know, data is going to be shared and all this, like some of the stuff we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. You know, what do you think about this? I mean, do you think that the tension between keeping the data proprietary to enhance commercial value, you know, versus making it free and widely available to power research is a legitimate argument? You know, is there a legitimate tension there? And, you know, do you think that the pressure or the desire to make money off the data will end up, you know, driving the outcome of that tension?
I think that I do not believe that there is a shortcut there that we can take people's data and put it in files and sell it for money. I don't believe that that is going to be a sustainable business model. What I do believe is that when you pool large amounts of data from large numbers of patients, then that becomes a valuable resource to read from. And then from that to make judgments about what kind of treatments you can develop in the future. So I believe that that's possible without, in many cases, divulging the identity of individuals involved. And so I think that is probably a more sustainable business model. And I also believe that if you speak to patients who are, so a lot of the objections about sharing medical data comes from people who are privacy advocates, but whenever we have asked patients what they believe and what they think should happen to their data, most people tend to believe that in the surveys that I have seen, they believe that if something good can come out of their data, they're willing to share. And this is about 70 to 80% of people who suffer from a chronic disease. So I think that this idea that there are these evil forces trying to harness people's data and then sell it to someone, I don't think that is as true as some people would like you to believe.
So you spent quite a number of years in research on the Genome Project and other things, and you somehow made your way to venture capital. What was the path there, and what was your very first investment and how did it do?
So the path was interesting. It as with most interesting things, I was at the right place at the right time.
Right. Isn't that always the way? Huh?
Yeah, genomics was becoming very popular as an investment thesis, and this is the peak of the Gartner curve we're talking about in early 2000s when venture capitalists wanted to invest in that sector, and because of my training in the sector, I was headhunted to join a fund. Where I started to invest, and my first investment was in a company based out of the UK, which was an oncology company, and their product actually came out 2 years ago. So finally, I've seen the end-to-end process of a company that had a preclinical compound to now a product that's approved.
And how long, so how many years was that from start to finish?
Well, that product was preclinical in 2001 and it was approved 2015 or 14.
Wow, is that after the life, after the lifetime of the fund's over? Or?
Yeah, but we managed to sell that company to another company, so we got a nice exit from it. But it was taken up by another company, which then approved it.
I guess a question that sort of seems to come up a lot is, you know, there's this sort of aura of around, you know, sort of like being an investor or being, you know, a venture capitalist. And I think, you know, people wonder, what, you know, the way you've described it seems to be, I mean, I remember a number of, you know, around the time that you did it, you know, there were like a bunch of people, often management consultants, some other people, or people went to management consulting or went to investing, people who were, less like you're saying, headhunted out of, you know, medical or, you know, research roles to join these funds. What's harder to get a sense of is, what was the transition like and what surprised you most about being an investor? In other words, being smart about medicine research is lovely, but what was most difficult to learn, most unexpected about becoming an investor?
I think the most unexpected thing of being an investor was the fact that you have to actively seek risk, because the general tendency that we are all born with, and we have an evolutionary drive to run away from risk. But in venture capital, you have to run towards risk. So you have to move away from companies where there is no risk. If somebody walks through the door and saying, I have a very low risk investment for you, then you should probably not have that meeting, because that's not going to make you a good return, assuming laws of economics work. So that was one of the first most counterintuitive thing that I learned. And the other thing that I learned was that you know, sometimes you had inconvenient moments and you had confrontations, which was not at all different from academia and venture capital. But in venture capital, the stakes were worth it. So in a lab, you fight over a small bench space of 6 inches. And you know, people can have feuds with their colleagues about tiny things. But in venture capital, we had feuds, but they were you know, it was really worth having those feuds because the stakes were high enough. So that's how I saw academia different from venture capital. Human instinct remains the same.
So that's interesting. I know Martin Kelly, the CEO of HealthXL, when he was speaking of you recently, called you an agitator by nature. He meant it as a compliment, obviously, that you like to shake things up. So is that... It sounds like that's consistent with your view on venture capital. You really need to shake things up.
Yeah, you do have to shake things up. I think that venture capital, one of the things, I think what David was saying, I think that it was used to be true, and it's probably true a lot more for biotech investors, that they don't tend to be, they tend to be seen as different from the community. But I find that that is actually quite a negative way of running a business, to not be approachable. And I find that, you know, I'm much more approachable by people. I'm on Twitter. I write a blog occasionally. People can approach me anytime they like, because I love great ideas. I love listening to people's stories. And somehow it wasn't like that when I first started in venture capital industry, that investors wanted to be far removed from the community.
Right. No, that's so interesting, because they were sort of like this class apart. And I think actually one of the key drivers of change was actually Andreessen Horowitz, who more or less pioneered like a PR-driven VC, where by being incredibly user-friendly and supportive and, you know, actively a member of the community, you know, I think they've definitely changed the profile of the whole venture business. One VC question I had for you is, comment that Brooke Byers, I remember making, famously made, is, you know, the real challenge is, on the one hand, as an investor, you obviously have to be extremely, you know, skeptical, and to, you know, you can't invest in the thousands of pitches that you get. On the other hand, I think he said that once you become cynical, once you sort of, you know, lose the optimism or lose the hope, you should get out of the game. So how do you walk that line between being critical but still hopeful? How have you found that that balance?
I think it's absolutely right what you're saying, because you can become too cynical in this business, because unless you strongly, it comes back to what I originally said, is that you have to believe that new things will happen and technology will make the world a better place. So you constantly have to look for that glimmer of hope in the eyes of an optimistic founder, and then back them. And that's, I think, how I overcome my cynicism. Whenever I'm feeling a little bit cynical, I pick up the phone and call one of my founders, and they're never cynical. They're always optimistic. They're always looking for the next big thing that they can do to improve the outcome of their business.
I think there's an ICD-9 code for ICD-10 code for that, but yeah.
Sometimes they're so optimistic that they're completely wrong.
If there was no probability of being wrong, then you will never make money from that business. The only way to make money from venture capital, and this is something I keep reminding myself every day, is that you have to take the risk, because there has to be a risk of failure in the business. Otherwise, you might as well just do real estate.
Real estate, where there's definitely a risk of failure. So you spent 12 years investing in primarily in biotech and genomics, and then in 2012, you made a major shift to explore digital health. What drove that change? I mean, that is a pretty profound change in focus.
I think mostly it was about looking at how different healthcare was and how little information people had when they acted on important things. So, you know, if you go back to the world in the 80s and 90s, most industries had very little information. Retail stores had very little information about their customers. Car companies had very little information about the environment. If you look at all industries, they were like that. And in the 80s and 90s, that completely changed with the information revolution. But healthcare remained the same. Even today, if you will make significant decisions in people's lives which may affect their lifespan, like giving them Lipitor, and you only take 4 or 5 data points into account to do that. And as a result, your interventions are not hugely effective or personalized. And so by looking at that, I thought that it's probably imaginable, given the outcomes are so important in healthcare, that people would want more information to make those decisions. And by taking more information into account, you could make better decisions. So that is, if you think, the fundamental thesis of digital health. And that then transforms to the next stage, where, you know, there are patients who are quite aware of their conditions and they are able to take control of their own health in better ways. So that creates the thesis of having wearable devices or having telemedicine. So if you look at that from that ground foundation, then you can go step by step to look at various different elements of digital health.
So one of the, in terms of where there's the theoretical benefit versus where there's investment, I just heard the other day a talk from the SVP of global healthcare at Accenture say where tech and healthcare investments are actually currently being distributed. And he said the lion's share are actually going for infrastructure, followed by consumer engagement, followed by treatment, followed by diagnosis, because he just said it's basically focused on where benefits are most realizable in the short term. How does that conceptualization square with your own experiences and where you're putting your own money?
So I think that there is some truth in that. So there is a lot of low-hanging fruit, and there should be no embarrassment to try and pick that. So, for example, telemedicine, it's a sector I've invested in. There is a huge amount there's a huge gap between what patients expect versus what the healthcare system can deliver.
I want to focus on telemedicine for a second, because that's a great example. It's in the news all the time. What I keep hearing about it is, on one hand, like employer-sponsored healthcare system, they love it. People like Kaiser are all into it. But doctors are like the biggest impediment to implementing telemedicine, from everything I hear, are the doctors themselves, how doctors and doctor groups are resisting it. Has that been your experience, and how do you overcome that?
So I have heard about that, but in where we are invested, so my company is currently operating only in the UK, and we were aware of this being a potential challenge. So the company's focus has been to engage doctors from the very beginning. And we have a very, very engaged workforce. We have 7,000 doctors in our network, which for a country of 60 million is quite a large number. And we have doctors who are very happy to work on our platform. And we do that by giving them, of course, we pay them well, but we also give them opportunities to advance their careers. We also give them opportunity to understand that telemedicine is a platform which is going to be there for a very long time, and they will probably spend more time on it going forward. So we have almost created it as a specialty. So we actually interview our candidates, doctors to come in, and our doctors go through a training program to becoming telemedicine doctors.
You have to train them to become broadcasters effectively.
Yes, that's probably a part of it.
Charm school for doctors.
Yeah.
But didn't George Clooney get like his start on ER? Wasn't that dating myself here?
So if you actually go to the website of this company, Push Doctor, we actually have a number of videos of our doctors talking about their own experiences of becoming telemedicine doctors. And it's actually very instructive because none of these doctors went to medical school thinking that they will actually be seeing patients through a computer.
That's interesting. I think about a company like this. So you're describing company in the UK, PushMD. There's at least, 700 of these companies that are telemedicine companies enabling doctors to interface with their patients. For every, one in Europe, there's three in the US and
zero
vice
in
versa.
Texas.
Why is there so much duplication in this digital health world? It seems, to be almost unavoidable, this incredible amount of duplication. What do you think about that?
So the fund that I work with, we invest in digital innovation across the board. It's not just healthcare. And what I've learned from digital investing in other consumer facing sectors is that it's actually not such a terrible thing if you have a number of people operating in one sector. One, it makes the sector more interesting. And oftentimes what happens as the end game is a consolidation. So the best player and the best funded player ends up consolidating the sector. So if you turn back the clock a few years, one of our portfolio companies was a company called Love Film, which used to distribute, which was like the Netflix of Europe.
That wasn't going to be my first guess for what that was.
So that was acquired by Amazon, which is now Amazon Prime Video in Europe. So which was an amalgamation of five or six companies that were trying to do something very similar. They got together, became a large organization, which was then acquired by a bigger company. So it's not always a terrible thing if there are more than one operator in the market. When we started Push Doctor, which is the company in my portfolio, there were several other telemedicine companies, and many of them have closed shop now because the ones that are bigger are definitely doing better than the smaller ones, and they're unable to compete.
Once again, size matters.
See, I always thought it was what you did with it.
On a separate note entirely. Michelle, unlike many VCs, you have openly talked about a trend towards more diversity among innovators and diversity in gender and diversity in cultural background, and that is a good and powerful thing. Why do you think this is actually happening? I mean, I think there's a lot of people who would argue that it's not happening. Do you think this diversity and the growth of it is a global phenomenon?
No, I think this is a global phenomenon. I think the flattening of the world continues. So I'm looking at, for example, to invest in machine learning businesses, and I compiled a list of companies that are applying machine learning in healthcare, and I have a list of 97 companies, and they come from countries that I have not even visited. So they come from Eastern Europe, they come from China, they come from India, they come from everywhere. So I think the whole innovation industry itself has spread quite widely now. I spent a large part of my life in London, which is a very multicultural city. And we, rarely ever think about, despite what you read in the press after Brexit and other things, we it's a fairly diverse industry, and our teams are composed of peoples of many nationalities. And our companies are run by people who come from different parts of the world.
Are there also diversities on the gender side that you're seeing come to life?
Yes, we are seeing diversity in the gender side. In fact, we've had that in many of our companies. So when I was doing biotech, for example, we had not only did we have founders, female founders that we backed, and that not only that, we actually backed husband-wife teams as well, and we made money from those companies, which is, you know, a textbook case of a higher risk business.
No,
but
you just take a carried interest in the divorce proceedings. Is that how it goes?
Probably funny because it's true.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that.
I think that there is still a gap. I mean, it's very, very obvious. If you just go through the list of meetings you do, you find that founders tend to be men.
Yeah, we have a passing familiarity with this.
But it's changing. I see that change every day. I see female founders. There are organizations like Health Tech Women, for example.
C-Sweetener.
Yeah, and C-Sweetener, of course, which is your organization. So yes, there are a lot of, I think that awareness is the first step, and then I think that change comes after that.
First awareness, then admitting there's a problem. Well, you know, Vishal, this has been terrific talking to you. I appreciate so much your talking to us from London here in your afternoon, and sharing your experience with us.
And our spirit of deja vu.
Exactly.
It's terrific being with you again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Today's guest, Vishal Gulati, was speaking to us today from the UK, where he's a venture investor for DFJ Esprit.
That was very interesting. I thought he had a very optimistic take on the advantages of a crowded space, the hopefulness of digital health. I mean, he really does exemplify the sort of optimism and hope that, as you know, one needs to have in both digital health and genetics and in probably healthcare investing in general.
Yeah, no, I was particularly interested that he, right at the moment that the genetics world sort of hit the second upswing in the Gartner hype cycle, the good part, right? He moved over to digital health. So I guess he really does believe in his theory that you should start at the risky end of the spectrum.
Right. Well, it's really be interesting to see how it all turns out.
Well, you can follow David Shaywitz's writing at Forbes.
And you can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report. We're grateful to HealthXL for sponsoring this episode of Tectonics. HealthXL is a global enterprise that empowers leading organizations and innovators to solve major healthcare problems through digital health collaborations.
This episode of Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonic Studio B in Mill Valley, California.
Ciao.